How many of you guys in here, imagine this scenario with me for a second, and then tell me how you feel about it, how it strikes you. You're up in the morning, getting ready for the activities of the day, and you have your coffee or tea or whatever it is that you that gets you in the mood to go out and take on the world. And it's just about 7 o'clock, so you turn the TV on to watch today, and they start off with big scenes of some activity of the royal family, and if there's ever the royal wedding or whatever. How many of you men in here really sit up and take notice and really enjoy that scene? How many of you really are carried away with the royal activities? There's a remarkable lack of enthusiasm in this group. You have noticed in Western culture, at least in the media, how much attention how much fascination there is with the British royal family, and especially if there's an event like a wedding or a birth or something like that. So noticing here, inattentiveness to those kind of things, I'm a little worried about how you'll respond to the title of this class. There is, however, one huge difference between us and Israel in the Old Testament, and it is, of course, that in their world, the entire well-being, the entire hopes and dreams of the nation were bound up in the experience of the king. And a large part of that the reason for that is that they operated based on God's covenant that he made with David. If you guys remember 2 Samuel 7 especially, where God promises David that he is going to raise up that he's going to establish David's throne forever, that he's going to raise up a son of David and set him on the throne and bless his rule and bless his kingdom forever. That covenant becomes the hope and the security of Israel in a very, very uncertain world. And even after the kingdom divides, still in Jerusalem, there is hope in the lineage of David and in the king from the line of David, and that makes this song of more interest to Bible students. And then it becomes more so because this is a song which the New Testament again specifically quotes and applies to Jesus. And it is a song which is sort of the doorway to one of the most important, meaningful images of the church of the Lord that there is in the Bible. And I hope that when we leave class today, we'll be impressed with the joy the king takes in his people. If I can tell you the main point of the class today, that's it. The joy the king takes in his people. Now, that to the text of Psalm 45 for a few minutes. And let me say one other thing before we start reading the text itself. If you're paying attention to where we've been with these the messianic psalms, notice the wide range of human experience that these attachments of the Messiah with the human experience are drawn from. In Psalm 2, there's the coronation of a king, and all of the majesty that went with that. In Psalm 16, Psalm 16 is the one, I call it the resurrection psalm, where God won't let His Holy One see corruption, and He's set His feet in a broad place. In Psalms 22 and 31, these are the psalms of suffering unfairly, where the enemies are unjustly against this representative of God. In Psalm 40, it's the king who the one who comes to do the Father's will that we read about last week. And now this time the image is drawn from the wedding, the royal wedding. And this is a song for the wedding, and probably a song that was used for the wedding of more than one king. It is said to be from the sons of Korah. They were a priestly group attached to the worship of the temple. And so you have the priest in praise of the king, of the people of God, the covenant people of God in that way. Now, here's the way this psalm is laid out. Verse 1 and verse 17 are the two bookends of the song. And both of them have reference to the intention of this singer to praise the king. Not just the king's wedding, but to praise the king. Verses 2 and 16 are sort of the next step inward from toward the middle of the psalm, and both of them are about the praise that is due to this king from the princes and so forth of all the earth. And then the two main parts of the psalm are verses 3 through 9, which have to do with the glory of this king whose wedding this is, and then verses 10 through 15, which have to do with the glory of the king's bride. And then each of those two main sections have two parts. And in verses 4 through, really verses 3 through 7, the reason for the king's glory is given, and then verses 8 and 9 describe his glory, and then verses 10 through 12, the reason for the bride's glory is described, and then verses 13 through 15, her glory itself. So that's the way the psalm unfolds. Now, you can imagine all the, since we've used the phrase pomp and circumstance, all of that that would have gone with the ceremony of this wedding and all of the glory of it and so forth. And have that in your mind and think along with us here as we read it. Becky, get verse 1 for us to start with.
My heart overflows with a good theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer.
All right. Does this writer dread what he is about to sing, or is this a burden to him? It's not a song of woe. It's not a sad song. It's a song of joy. Now, verse 2 through 5 are the praise offered to the king. And let's ask Brendan to read those for us, if you will, Brendan.
You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips, therefore God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword up on your thigh, O mighty woman, in your splendor and your majesty. And in your majesty ride on victoriously, for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome things. Your arrows are sharp, the peoples fall under you. Your arrows are in the heart of the king's enemies.
All right. Now, I want to, for a special reason, I want to jot down the thoughts that are mentioned here. Notice that this, in appearance, the king is described as being fairer than the sons of men. Some of the versions will say most excellent of the sons of men or most handsome of the sons of men. So in appearance, there is the idea of excellence. In his lips, notice his lips, and therefore the words upon his lips are said to involve graciousness in verse 2. He is blessed of God how long?
Forever.
Forever. All right. He's blessed forever. The other things that can be seen of him indicate that God has blessed him. Notice how his majesty is described. He has a sword that he uses to go out and win whatever battle is there as a mighty one. He rides out victoriously. And then notice carefully that this is for the cause of what? Verse 4.
Truth.
All right, the cause of truth.
Meekness.
And righteousness. All right, this is the, in other words, it is not just this king's honor that is there, but the cause of truth, meekness, and righteousness. And then notice that peoples, it says in verse 5 especially, peoples fall under him. All right, now look at that phrase, and you'll get those phrases, and you get an idea of the key things here about the rule of this king that are being praised. It is, in other words, it is not just for his wedding. It's not just for him. It's for the cause of God and for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Now, we'll bear that in mind while we read the next part of this. Verses 6 through 9. Next. Dan, you want to read that for us, please? 6 through 9.
Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy above your fellows. All your garments are fragrant with myrrh and alloys and cassia. Out of ivory palaces, stringed instruments have made you glad. Your king's daughters are among your noble ladies. At your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir.
All right, now, starting from the end of that, looking back up through it, the glory of the outcome of this ceremony is such that the queen stands there in the finest gold, and you take it that this gold is probably represents jewelry, very, very precious and the most valuable at all. The attendants at this, in this king's court for this wedding are the daughters of kings. If you notice the first part of verse 9. Indicating that he is a man of international fame and honor, in that way, the ivory palaces and the stringed instruments indicate joy and luxury of the celebration. The fragrances, the smells of this occasion are of these fragrant spices. Myrrh and aloes and cassia. And then notice verses 6 and 7 especially. Starting at 6, observe that it says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. This is a phrase that has been subject to two interpretations that I notice. One is that the idea that possibly it is being said that the throne of the king of Israel was actually the throne that belonged to God, and that this king of this covenant people ruled as God's representative, and God would always be the king of his people. And in that way, this king's majesty is being recognized because of his special relationship with the God at whose pleasure he ruled. That, of course, is a possibility. And when you look at it in context in that way, you'll notice that verse 7 does say midway through, therefore, God, your God, has anointed you. Does everybody see that? So, in one way of looking at it, that's a possibility. The other way of taking this is that this This is a statement that is totally predictive of the Messiah who is coming. That he, according to Isaiah 9 and verse 6, there's going to be someone sent to be the king who will be the mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, Wonderful Counselor. You remember that great statement? That this coming king would be anointed. Isaiah 61 makes reference to his being anointed with the Spirit and therefore able to bring sight to the blind and healing to the lame and so on, if you remember that passage. Now, what is the telling thing about this is the use that the writer of the book of Hebrews makes of this passage. Look at Hebrews 1 and verses 8 and 9. Hebrews 1, verses 8 and 9. In Hebrews, the writer is encouraging them to realize that they have the best there is in Christ. And he uses several of these Old Testament passages to say this is fulfilled in Christ. This is about Christ. So read this passage for us. Barney, you got it?
Hebrews 1, 8 and 9.
Mm-hmm.
But to the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness more than your companions.
All right, now what seems to you to be the telling phrase in that reading? Of the Son, he said this, or the King James, to the Son, he said this. So, if this were in Psalm 45, a song to the King that was happening then the Hebrew writer would be saying, but only as a shadow of the real one to come. That, in other words, that this would be finally fulfilled in Jesus. And so, read it and think of it that way. He has a throne which is forever and ever. He's exalted at God's right hand. He rules over His kingdom. He will do so until the last enemy is destroyed. Then that kingdom will be delivered up to the Father, but the kingdom itself will never end. That's the idea. Alright? The scepter of His kingdom, what is a scepter? All right, it is the symbol of authority, but a stick or a rod that the king would hold in his hand to indicate the use of his power and his authority. What is the nature of his rule? Verse 7, first part. All right, it's righteousness. It's one where the king loves what? Righteousness and hates wickedness. This is not a morally indifferent ruler, and he is not an unjust ruler. Both have to be true of him. Now, does that fit Christ? If you follow this idea, Christ is enthroned above every power that there is at the end of Ephesians 1. He has a scepter of righteousness. He loves wickedness. He loves righteousness and hates wickedness. God has anointed him. You might remember that when Jesus stands up in the synagogue in Luke chapter 4 at the beginning of his ministry and asks for the scroll, or takes the scroll of Isaiah and finds the place and reads He especially reads from Isaiah 61 that the Lord has anointed him, and he tells what for. And then the oil of gladness beyond his companions. Now, those ideas are impressive. That means that each of these things takes on a different meaning when you look at them through the prism of the rule or the throne of Christ or the rule of Christ. His gracious words, Luke 4:22, I believe, says that his being blessed forever would fit with his being enthroned forever. The majesty of his kingdom or the majesty of his rule is the resurrection majesty. The truth and the meekness and the righteousness are all terms that are closely associated with the character of Christ and how he goes about it. And then his ruling a kingdom that's made up of all tribes and tongues and peoples and nations. Revelation 5 verses 9 and 10 would be a great way to illustrate that. Now, if the New Testament does attach the first half of this song to the Christ, and I hope you can see from Hebrews 1 it does. We could show a number of other passages that are attached here. But who then will... What about the bride? Let's read about the bride in this song for a moment and kind of get ready for the other part of our class here. In verse 10 beginning, look what we read here. Michelle, one of you guys want to read for us verse 10 starting?
Okay. Listen, O daughter, consider it and incline your ear. Forget your own people also and your father's house. So the king will greatly desire your beauty, because he is your lord. Worship him. And the daughter of Tyre will come with a gift. The rich among the people will seek your favor.
Keep going. Okay.
The royal daughter is all glorious within the palace. Her clothing is woven with gold. She shall be brought to the king in robes of many colors. The virgins, her companions who follow her, shall be brought to you. With gladness and rejoicing they shall be brought. They shall enter the king's palace.
All right, now we stop here. And what we notice here is the idea of the wedding procession and the wedding feast and all of that part of the story. Now, when we get to the New Testament, who do we learn, or who do we find being the bride of the king that we've talked about here? The church. This is the picture of the church that is the picture of the Lord's relationship with his covenant people. That's maybe the most familiar, the most frequently used. I can think of a few of these passages, I think. Is it 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 2? Or 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2, isn't it? Where this picture is used. Of course, Ephesians 5, verses 26 and 27 would be another place where this idea is used. And then there are the passages that use the idea of the wedding feast that are very prevalent. And then Revelation 19, the hallelujah chorus, because the marriage of the Lamb. Blessed are those who are invited to the marriage feast of the Lamb. Now, what I'm suggesting here is not simply that Psalm 45 is predictive of all of that. I am saying that the Bible laid the groundwork in the experiences of the people of God throughout the ages for us to be able to understand or to have a shadow, at least, of what what the relationship between God and His people ultimately are supposed to mean. Now, was I right with the Second Corinthians 11, where Paul writes to the church of God at Corinth, and he says, "I've espoused you to the Lord as a bride in that way." Ephesians 5 and verses 26 and 27. We might read this one especially. Somebody have it found already for us? Okay, Dan.
"So that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of her, by the washing of water with
back
the
up,
word."
Back up one verse and start. Okay.
"Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, and that she should be holy and blameless."
All right. So the bride here is loved, and self is given up for her, and she is cleansed and all of and presented to him in all her glory, without any blemish or spot or any such thing. And there's the point there is about the relationship that exists between the two. Matthew 22 is the wedding feast parable, verses 1 through 14. And the key thing here is all the trouble that this king goes to make the wedding feast and to invite people to come. And then, of course, people ignored the privilege of it. And then Revelation 19, the Lord's coming is pictured in terms of the marriage feast of the Lamb. Now, here's a question that I want to ask. What message does to the people of God, what message is this image intended to communicate to us? What this isn't a song a poem that is in the Bible just for because of the wedding of a particular king. There is some message that is meant to be communicated to the Lord's people. There's something that He wants us to learn from this picture. What do you think it is? All right. The idea that the church relates to its Lord like this beautiful bride here, and the privilege of it. Of course, there are other passages in the Bible that add to this thought. The Song of Solomon would be one possibility. There are great pictures of the part of this when faithfulness is not present that are really striking in Old Testament history. Ezekiel 16 is one case, and the book of Hosea is another one. Any other messages that you think really ought to press themselves on our memories? If we had a wedding album and all the pictures out of this whole thing here, what would we learn from it? I want to call your attention to the phrases in the song, in this part of the song. What about verse 10, when the bride here, or the daughter who's being married to this king, is told to forget your people and your father's house? What does that mean?
Some people who are converted to the church have given up their family.
All right, all right. There is a call here to a greater loyalty. I'll just write loyalty here, but I want you to have in mind what Yvonne just said. This covenant that exists here calls for a superior loyalty than that to the father's house or to the previous homeland. Village or community or whatever it is. That point is one that is prominent here. Second, in verse 11, it talks about the desire for one another. And now this is your Lord, and you bow down before Him, or to worship Him. And the idea here would be not only the loyalty, but also the religious service, if we could think of it that way. And I'm going to use the word love in order to illustrate the meaning of this, or the point of this. I think that's the idea that is here. Devotion, in other words, would be maybe a better word that exists here. And then there is the faith, I think. Verse 12, 13, along in there is the faith here that it is in this union I'll use also the faith or the confidence that there is in this union is where the bride's glory is going to come from. It's where the rewards in life are going to come from. The people bring their rich gifts to her in verse 10. And then her loyalty to him, since he loves her and gives himself for her to make her glorious, she believes that his loving her is going to be the source of her greatest glory and honor. She's not going to have to find that fulfillment somewhere else. And over time, of course, this is where the glory does come from. In that the love shared between the Lord and His people. And verses 16 and 17 end by saying that nations will praise this king and his bride forever and ever. Now, what these songs do is to give us the imagery and the language with which to understand the blessing that we have in being the Lord's people. It gives us the prayer language, the praise language, the conceptualization of what this is like. And it does so in a way that allows us to take our point of reference not from ourselves as opposed to other religious groups in the world, but from the best of human experience with a king and his people and the wedding feast that goes on in association to their union. And in that way, if we read these psalms over and over and meditate on them, it gives us reason to count our blessings. It gives us something to live for. I hope it strikes us in that way and encourages us in that way. When you go talk to the rest of your family today, you tell them when they ask what you studied in your class, we studied about a wedding. Please say it with a smile, all right? Thank you guys for being with us this morning.